New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Jason Tebow, a marketing and creative strategist and co-author of Recommend This, Delivering Digital Experiences People Want to Share. He's the executive director of the Streaming Video Alliance, a not-for-profit organization and worldwide consortium of companies dedicated to helping shape the future of online video. He's dedicated to helping companies maximize their relevance in the digital space by generating innovative ideas, managing products, building software, redefining processes, and generating content. Jason, thanks for joining us today. So, jumping in, when we think about marketing and promotion, and with your background, it's sort of perfect. Should we even consider digital as a separate thing anymore, or is it marketing and promotion? You've just got to consider it as this universe that you're occupying.
So, great question, and I would definitely say that it's no longer a discrete channel. I think that in order for marketing to be effective, it has to be omni-channel now. So you've got to think about, what am I doing offline? What am I doing online? And not as channels, but as part of a cohesive strategy.
Right. Transmedia, I guess, would be the sort of old word we were using for that. So one of the things I run into is, you know, this doesn't simply mean you've created a spot for air and we're going to change the aspect ratio, right?
Right.
So, you'd be surprised. How does the medium change the creative? How do you have to think about it differently?
Well, I mean, I think with, you know, digital channels, you have much more of an opportunity to be interactive. So you can't really interact with a magazine. You can't really interact with a television commercial, but you can interact with a banner ad. You can interact with an engaging story that's online that may combine multiple types of media, you know, into a single cohesive storyline. So I think that's important. That's what's really different about the digital versus the non-digital. And again, not as channels, but just as a means by which people can engage with content in different ways.
Right, right. So if we're looking at this landscape and we have this environment and we have linear and we have over-the-top services, and it's fractured, and I think you've described it as purgatory for the user, which I think is pretty accurate. What would you say are best practices that might have emerged to navigate this in terms of creating messaging for content discovery?
Ooh, wow, that's a heavy question. Best practices that have emerged. Yeah, I'm off the top of my head, I can't really think of any.
None. Sorry.
No, the reason I say that is I don't think any have emerged yet.
Huh.
I think we're still struggling in trying to figure out how to bring everything together into a single cohesive experience. And so, like, look at what happened recently with CBS All Access. So they've just struck a deal with the NFL.
Right.
That will bring live linear games to their video on demand platform.
Right.
And I think that's great, but does it really help content discovery at all? Because people know that content is there. What about content that may not be so obvious? That's the problem, I think, that hasn't been solved yet by anybody. And I don't really think there are best practices to say this is how you improve content discoverability across different platforms. Because again, I think right now people are in this sort of let's just test it out mode and see if it works. And if it works, then let's keep using it until something better comes along.
Right. Well, except, you know, one thing that was kind of interesting was I read an article in Forbes, which used my survey data, which is why I read the article actually about about pirating, And what was interesting was what the young millennials were pirating were the debates. Now, the debates were free. They didn't need to pirate them. So why were they pirating them? And you have to wonder about promotion. It's a failure. I mean, this is a, how did people not know where to tune in? You know, how did they not know how to watch this stuff? Why were they choosing to pirate it? It's kind of a mystery to me.
That is really bizarre. That is fascinating data.
Yeah. Right. What's up with that? And if they're going to, I mean, especially this election cycle. So then anybody promoting a show really has their work cut out for them, because certainly there was a lot of cultural reverb around those debates, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't understand why they were pirating it. I can understand why they were consuming it. I mean, just as to punctuate what you just said,
right?
You know, there was a lot of interest in what was happening with the elections and, you know, what people were watching. And it's funny, we're getting ready, the Streaming Video Alliance is getting ready to publish our first consumer research report on mobile video.
Ooh.
And one of the things that we found is that people were watching a lot of news content on their phones. Mm. And when you think about it, it actually makes a lot of sense, right? Because that's what was filling up the airwaves, the quote unquote airwaves, in the digital world because of the election cycle. And so it makes sense that people were watching that content more often. So I get it. I get why younger people were consuming it. But the whole concept of pirating the debates is just I can't even wrap my head around that.
Right. Right. Well, I'm interested. Are you going to redo your study and see if there's a change when you're not in sort of a political hotbed? You know,
So we have plans to refield the study either once or twice a year, so that we can start to generate some trends around what's happening.
Right. What's your sample size?
Now, we only at this point, it's only 500.
Okay.
It's a very small sample.
Okay. Okay. The other thing I had read on your blog, you were talking about invention and innovation and the difference and the how they could be same, how they could be different, how you know, we see a lot about first mover, but sometimes followers can lead. And can you explain how you could be an innovative follower?
Oh, no, absolutely. I actually think Facebook is probably the quintessential innovative follower, or they were. They have since moved into a land of invention. But really what they started out as doing was taking the best features from other social networks and combining them in a unique and innovative way that allowed them to build the platform upon which we, you know, waste so much of our time today. You know, and it's when you think about it, you think about patents in that manner. So the patent landscape is very interesting in that a patent can be one of two things. It can be a purely novel invention. So you create something that no one has created before and you patent it, or you can actually innovate off other people's patents and patent the innovation. So that was really what I was kind of after, was this concept of it's fine to be an inventor, which is great. You've created something new that people may or may not want. But I think what's more interesting for businesses, and this obviously lends itself to marketing, it lends itself to engineering, it lends itself to, you know, all sorts of disciplines within the enterprise. But being innovative really just means, you know, looking out across the landscape in an industry and seeing where you can improve upon what's already been done.
Do you need scale to do that? I mean, for instance, you had Google come up with Google Plus and try to upend Facebook, and it didn't really happen, right? So
yeah.
they had the deep pockets, they had the wherewithal to do it, but they failed to do it. And I would say that they're a creative company. They certainly have the minds there. So what would it be? Do you reach a sort of a critical mass where you're not going to be able to be disrupted, or you aren't going to be able to be innovated against, I guess? You may be disrupted, but it's got to be coming at it from a completely oblique angle.
It really does have to come at an oblique angle. And look what happened with Oculus Rift, right? So you've got this VR headset. Facebook comes along and says, wow, we think VR is the future of social media. And basically Oculus is innovating and inventing. So they started inventing, and then, you know, they're probably innovating and inventing at the same time now. They're looking at what HTC is doing with Vive. They're looking at what others are doing, and they're probably taking and tweaking. But what did Facebook do with that? They just acquired them. So when you get to a point where you reach an economy of scale, it is really hard to innovate against you. And it becomes more of an issue of, you know, can I do something that addresses a subset of what that company is all about? So, you know, using Facebook as an example, could Google Plus have said, you know, maybe instead of trying to replicate the Facebook experience, we focus on one thing and we do it better than Facebook is doing it. So we innovate really well in that space and we see if we can generate the kind of interest that we want to generate instead of trying to do what they did, which is build out and replicate the entire thing at the same time.
Right. So if you were then thinking, here's a network, a traditional network, and they look at Netflix, for instance, and what they've done, are you suggesting that rather than trying to build, we're going to have a million different over-the-top platforms and it's going to be fabulous, instead looking at user interface and making it even better on what they have for the one offering? Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Yeah, so actually the Netflix idea is very interesting because I think you're starting to see a lot of competitors nip away at Netflix's heels, and they're doing so not with the experience of OTT, but they're doing it with the content.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's where they focused on. So instead of innovating on how people engage or interact with the volumes of material that's going to be there, a lot of these smaller niche players have decided, wait a minute, you know where we can really innovate against is on the content. And we can get content that no one else has seen or that a huge portion of the population would love to get in a single offering, because Netflix is never going to add that kind of content, you know, to their OTT platform. So it's really just a matter of figuring out what the right angle is and then driving hard on that angle and innovating in that space versus, again, trying to recreate the entire wheel.
Right. But then again, I find myself looking at the discovery piece, because you have this long tail of content, and sure, you're right, Netflix isn't going to have, you know, Korean Viking reenactments, but perhaps there's a big market for that. But how does the ardent fan of Korean Viking reenactments, you know, how do they find it? You know, how does that happen?
You know, right now it's traditional marketing, spray and pray. Right? It's shotgun approach to the market. It's spend a lot of money to acquire eyeballs and hope you get, you know, a 7 or 8% stick rate. But that's unfortunately where we're still at right now. We just don't have, again, it goes back to the first question you kind of asked around these best practices for discoverability. They just aren't there. No one's figured that one out yet. I do believe at some point in the future that we are going to see meta services or Uber services crop up that begin to take content, really content metadata from lots of different providers, and give users an experience across the ecosystem. So instead of saying, I have to log into Netflix and I have to log into Hulu and I have to log into CBS All Access, et cetera, I log into this one service. And it's using some technology or partnerships or relationships or whatever it's using to aggregate all of this content together. So then what you have is, when you have that Korean Viking reenactments, you know, content provider come into the market, they go straight to the meta service and say, hey, we want you to catalog our content too.
Right, right. I think that they're... because I think people all are kind of saying, well, this is what needs to happen. But then you run into the walled gardens. And,
yes.
And so you have really entrenched vested interests in not, you know, in saying, fine, you know, you can come to our door. But the minute you want to cross in, that's our data, our people, our place. And no, thank you. You know, and certainly the biggest, heaviest hitters are probably going to be less interested than our Korean Viking reenactors, who are like, you know, index me, please.
I wrote a piece on that. I wrote a piece on that around collaboration is required for the industry to really move forward.
Right.
And that's what's got to happen. If we don't have collaboration, amongst the major players, then we're going to continue in this purgatory, this user purgatory that we're in today.
But what's the financial incentive for the people who are sitting with in the power position to collaborate? Are they at risk? I mean, you know, obviously it would be nicer for us, but aren't they potentially endangering themselves? And would anybody do that?
I think ultimately they are. Long term, they are endangering themselves. It's like the old incumbent broadcasters, you know, fighting against digital. It's the same thing. They're ultimately hurting themselves in the long run. And they came around. All of those broadcasters have come around to digital. The digital is important. And again, not as a separate channel, but as part of an omni-channel offering.
Right.
And so, you know, long term, these big players, the Verizons, the Comcasts, the Netflixes, you know, they're going to have to work together, or smaller niche content providers are just going to eat away at their subscriber base. Because that, I mean, and look what happened. So Time Warner acquired Drama Fever, right? So they acquired a niche content play. And there's dozens of these things out there now around, you know, specific types of content. So acquisition becomes an option, you know, again, like Facebook and Oculus, it becomes an option to
the big players.
To the big players to do something that seems innovative to their users, but is really a reaction to being innovated against.
Right.
And the problem ultimately is going to be if they just continue to acquire stuff, it becomes untenable. Right.
Well, I suppose they have to integrate it. It's sort of like NBC has what level stake in BuzzFeed now.
Right.
And at what point does BuzzFeed become part of the family in a more, you know, in a more obvious way, so it's integrated, or is it just a standalone thing? I mean, they were missing their revenue targets, right? That's why I think they were their valuation was what it was. So, I don't know what the answer is to that. Clearly,
that's the, you know, you've reached the crux of it. There is no answer to it, at least not today. I mean, there's lots of futures that we can, you know, prognosticate about. But ultimately, the problem today is you've got large content providers who are just trying to figure out what digital means to their overall strategy. You've got smaller niche players who are innovating against them with unique content offerings. And then really you've got a consumer who wants a consolidated experience, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for something that is TV-like in the digital space.
Right, right. That's interesting. I wonder, skipping around a little bit here, is I saw today Netflix had announced 20 plus original scripted programs.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, how do you, when you look at something like that and current subscriber fees, do you think they can really sustain that level of production? I mean, and how, you know, when you have linear TV, you have only so much air and you have this many primetime shows. And so this is how many we make every year. But when you're dealing with an over-the-top service, that number could be endless. What's the right number, and can you sustain it? And people are voracious in how they go through it. Is there enough?
Yeah. So I would argue that there's probably too much content. You know, how many people start binging a show and then stop because they either get distracted or they have other things to do or they find the content uninteresting the third episode in? So, you know, is it sustainable? Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon where you sit in the value chain, the answer is yes. There's going to be more content produced. So Amazon is doubling down. Netflix is doubling down. HBO is doubling down. You know, all these big content providers see the opportunity in front of them, which is if I can provide content, people will come to my service. That's really what it's about. It's if you build it, they will come.
Well, right. And that's the sort of the argument you were making. That's where you're innovating, is through your content, right?
Exactly. Yep. And you see that with HBO, you see it with Amazon, you see it with Netflix. They're all innovating because they recognize that in order to fend off the little guys nipping at their heels with, you know, weird content or, you know, cross-continent content, you know, whatever it is, niche content, they need to innovate. They need to produce shows that can only be found on their, you know, quote-unquote networks, because they are the new networks, right? You know, look at the deal that Comcast struck with Netflix.
Right.
So Netflix is going to be part of the Xfinity platform now. It's right. going to be a channel on the box.
Right.
And that to me is a true sign of the transition from linear broadcast television to, you know, online video or OTT.
Well, there's some cooperation right there, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
There. And what's interesting there, though, is that's a you have Comcast and you have NBC, and you think, how did NBC feel about Comcast doing that? interesting. Dipping back into piracy that we had talked about earlier. It's been argued that piracy serves as promotion. And certainly in music, there have been studies that looked at who was pirating music and said, you know, the people who are pirating the music aren't going to buy it anyway. They become evangelists and they then get other people to purchase the music. And I'm curious, do you believe that learnings from music piracy can be applied to video piracy? And do you believe that a similar thing is going on with video piracy? Certainly, Richard Plepler, HBO, has sometimes used leaks of, you know, Game of Thrones to, oh dear, you know, it got out. and now everybody knows how cool Game of Thrones is. Is piracy creating proto viewers, and is it fostering discovery, and is it then something that we actually think is okay?
That's a great question, and you know, lots of ways I can opine on this.
Opine away.
You know, I definitely think that enabling a certain amount of piracy, and I say enabling in the sense of, you know, not doing what the music industry did, which was go after everybody with cease and desist letters and prosecute people, and so you enable a certain amount of piracy by not necessarily having lax security or, you know, not legitimately going after people who are pirating with the intent to distribute, but you know not going after those individual pirates who may find something on a torrent site or a friend may send them a link. I think that does enable content to become a bit more widely known than it may.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on its own. And obviously, you know, people like HBO and Amazon and Netflix are using, you know, their marketing dollars to promote their content as well.
Right.
So there's some relationship between those two activities, between promotion and piracy, that ultimately benefits the content itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that piracy can be contained, or is it something that is always going to be present?
I think until somebody comes up with a really great security solution, which then somebody will crack anyway. piracy is part of the landscape. And it's unfortunate. I mean, again, if it's unfortunate in the sense of there are people out there who pirate with the intent to distribute. So their job is to say, I'm going to pirate this, and I'm going to distribute it to as many people as I possibly can. It's like, really?
Well, you know, and then there's it's interesting also, I think, that you have I think this is a generational thing, where you have a sense of, you know, copyright, schmoppyright, you know. So what, you put your heart and soul and blood and sweat into creating this thing. It's,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's on the internet and I'm going to share it. And I think that, you know, okay, fine, young sir or madam, you know, talk to me in 10 years after you've worked a little bit and made something of your own and see how you feel when people then put it up and take it and you don't
exactly.
get paid. You know, as you said earlier, you know, this stuff costs money to put together. I mean, you know, it isn't, if you want to have good content, it's going to cost. So somewhere, the revenue has to come from somewhere. And if we're all stealing it, then it won't come from anywhere.
Yeah, and those are the fringe people. I mean, those are the fringe pirates, I'll call them. you know, they're the you know, 0.0001% of the pirates. They're the people who are anti-establishment, anarchists. You know, they're, hey, everything should be free. We shouldn't have to pay for anything.
But they write a lot of comments. They write a lot of comments on Twitter and blogs.
Yes, they do.
So they're the trolls.
Yes, absolutely. And so, again, I mean, I'll give you an example. I pirated a movie a while ago. It was the first Star Trek, the new Star Trek that came out.
Okay.
And I saw it in the theaters and I absolutely loved it. I was like, oh my God, this is the best movie I've ever seen. I want to watch it again and again and again and again and again. So I pirated it. And the day it came out legitimately on iTunes, I bought it.
Okay. Okay.
Because I felt like, hey, I got a lot of value out of this. I owe these people my money for that value. That's what's fair. That's what's right. Hmm. And so I paid for it. And I, you know, I really just wanted the pirated version sort of to fill the gap because I wanted to watch it a bunch of times.
Well, and you had already watched it. You'd already watched it in the theater. So
exactly. So I paid twice, really.
Although I suppose you could have gone to the theater multiple times, like we all did when we were little and watched Star Wars.
That's true.
What excites you about the change that we see going on?
Oh, there is so much happening at such a fast pace. I am bummed. I am woefully bummed that I'm not going to live 1,000 years, right? Just to see all of this unfold, you know, and the bad with the good, right? So you've got climate change and you got man impacting the earth. And one of the things that humanity is really good at is coming up with ways to solve critical problems. And so what kind of technology is that going to unearth, you know, pun intended, right? It's really going to make some amazing things.
Right.
I mean, I recently read an article about somebody had developed a massive CO2 filter that was going to pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and you know, really sort of take away from the greenhouse effect and hopefully reduce some of the, you know, some of the temperature increases. And then I recently read an article about, you know, Germany's got an almost nuclear fusion reactor online.
Oh, wow.
And it's just some of these things, I'm so amazed at how fast things are happening in all sorts of different scientific and technological disciplines that it's just, that's what excites me. I get up in the morning and I'm like, what happened today? What's going to happen today? What happened yesterday? I just want to read and I get consumed by, you know, finding out these interesting things that are happening. And it's, I am amazed by humanity's perseverance and inventiveness.
Right. Right. Does anything worry you?
People. I think, you know, with all this great technology and all these great opportunities, it's people that ruin it. So if I always tell people, you just do the math, right? There's 7 billion people in the world. If 1%
somebody's going to mess it up.
1% of those people suck. You know, they're just nasty, mean people. That's 70 million people who are terrible. Oh. That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of terrible people.
It's a lot of terrible people. And that's just 1%. I mean, that's so minuscule. Ugh. And so it's that's what really worries me is that can we as a species, can we rise above the things that are, you know, that we hold at bay, which are ready to destroy us, which is ourselves? Can we do that? Can we become, you know, more civilized? Can we become more accepting, more understanding? Or are we always going to get in our own way?
Signs point to no at the moment, but
yes, they do. You are correct.
Sorry. Anyway, thank you so much for chatting with me. We're at the end of the interview. I really appreciate it. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking some people who have helped bring the program to life. First, a thank you and shout out to Rob Naughton, my friend and the voice artist who does the show's intro. Thank you to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest and new friend, Jason Thibault. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.